is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Another negative week for the market. Stocks on the negative side as assets began to pull back across the board here. And is this beginning of a correction and upward ahead? Well, you'll have to listen to what we have to say in the first hour. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Coming up in hour one, Dan Wobtrowski will be joining me from Albion Partners. And Dan thinks that we have been in a corrective phase in the market, but a time correction rather than a price correction. He's rather favorable on stocks over the longer term, especially with the millennials moving into family formation mode. Dan will be joining me in hour one. Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. And then Greg Weldon and I talk about gold. Greg has never been more bullish, so you're going to want to hear what he has to say about the gold markets. All of that coming up in hour number one.
And today for the big picture in hour number two, I'm John Loeffler. We put Jim on the record again and have him answer a lot of the questions listeners send to us from time to time. We'll have 10 or so major questions. We've emphasized dividend paying stocks. Is that still valid? We talk about bonds, but with interest rates rising, isn't that a risk? Many, many other such questions. All of that, that's the big picture today as Jim goes on the record. And Ryan Poplava, welcome back from your break last week. Small talk, small talk, small talk. So
good to be here, John. Good to talk to you too.
So what moved the markets this week? I mean, if we're asking that question, where's the focus and what stories are at the heart of discussion on Wall Street?
Well, John, you know, coming back this week, the story hasn't changed too much from when I left a couple weeks ago. You know, the rally in the market was very much driven by a lot of central bank movement, some of the economic news, which has improved, and some of that has removed some of the recession talk we saw in January. And remember, the jobs report for January was really low, but it hasn't removed everything completely. There is still many concerns voiced by many strategists out there, but it's a very different story now in that the bulls will basically need, at this point from the February rally, they'll really need to justify the current position of the market, which is nearly, you know, if we look at earnings, a PE ratio of around 17 and change and a move of nearly 12% off the bottom, really have to justify going forward what the growth prospects are for the economy globally, which is where concerns stemmed earlier this year. But as it stands today, John, some of the problems areas last year have been actually tailwinds this quarter, with the dollar falling based on some of the changes in Fed language. And you know, I call it really the flip-flop Fed, and oil's rally on freezing production level discussions. And, you know, finally, major moves, like I said already, that by the ECB, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan, the BOJ, to really ramp up their QE purchases. The ECB actually this time compared to December increase the purchases on a monthly basis, not just the duration of how long their plan is going to extend. And in some cases, like, you know, Bank of Japan and even the ECB, they lowered rates. So the main story this week, not much has changed. The dollar has weakened. Oil has rallied. But at this point, a lot of doubts are starting to sift in here. And a lot of the issues of how we were able to rally too was that, you know, a lot of the shorts, a lot of positions, a lot of the allocations by managers going short in January and February, a lot of that has been reversed. And when I look at asset levels and basically talking some of the trading desks to see where, you know, funds and managers are allocated today relative to a month ago.
Okay, so the Fed has gone on pause, and I know you've discussed how important it has been for the central banks to work in unison. The gap in policy divergence has led to a stronger dollar, which has already weighed on the U.S. economy as far as exports and multinational corporate earnings are concerned.
Yeah, and in a sense, you know, what we've talked about, you and I, John, over the past 6 months, is that alone, you know, raising the interest rates like they did in December, they've actually been tightening long before December in, you know, cutting back QE. A lot of the language which has been discussed by the Fed towards wanting to raise interest rates over the past year, a lot of that was a tightening process in and of itself, which strengthened the dollar just as all those other central banks were becoming more accommodative, weakening their policy in that sense to help their currencies lower and help their exports. You know, that divergence, you know, that's narrowed recently. And just as my brother Chris has coined in our quarterly newsletter, you know, as we're just kind of discussing the Fed here, the Fed has moved back into its position as the world central bank, not so much targeting, you know, its dual mandate in the U.S. of full employment and low inflation of around 2%. So, you know, we're near those targets now. And if we were a closed economy, it would make sense, right, for the Fed to not really be concerned about what's going on in Italy, Greece, Japan, et cetera, and maybe to normalize rates based on hitting those target levels. But John, the economy today, just not that simple, very much a globally integrated machine. And, you know, definitely the Fed has to be aware of what's going on over there. It's not as simple anymore to just talk about jobs and just to talk about price levels. Obviously, what we do here is we look at a lot of financial stress levels. We look at, you know, a lot of those things when it comes to getting an idea of how concerned are investors and how should we be positioning. But, you know, John, the Fed in March, it's a very much a different sounding Fed from December. You know, with the minutes out this week showing a lot of disagreement between the various members, a lot of counterpoints being addressed on all subject matters. And so the different voting members of the FOMC, there's a lot of disagreement. And whenever there's that kind of disagreement and they can't in unison, like seemingly they did in December, to raise interest rates, you know, they were all of one accord. When you've got these different voting members, different opinions, it's a lot harder for the Fed to unify behind a decision to either raise rates or stay paused. So usually when stuff like this happens, they wait to find out, hey, we need to sit here, pause a little bit, find out what's going on with the economy, get a consensus building, and then move forward with policy adjustments. But, you know, concerning economic growth, we heard, you know, just for example of the different opinions here, they said several participants fear the labor market will turn out to be stronger than anticipated, while many participants, kind of a counter argument here, cited a deterioration in global financial conditions. So prioritizing, I guess, you know, what should the Fed be focusing on? A lot of disagreement there. And it's funny because the St. Louis Fed president, James Bullard, had an interview on Bloomberg, I think, right after those minutes were released. And he basically said, we didn't get really much from the minutes. So, you know, I think he's right. But for now, it appears that gold, the dollar, and foreign currencies are happy about the pause we're getting, not necessarily the dollar, but probably multinationals. You know, it's going to be very interesting to find out what they're going to say here as the earnings season comes around the corner and get an idea for what their feeling is at the ground floor level for their production levels, their employment directions, and just to see what, you know, the weakness in the dollar recently here, what that's done for them. But, you know, I think Janet Yellen's communication last week was the voice that the consensus has built around as far as the market's concerned. And that's shaped most essentially the conversation, which is basically that monetary policy, despite the various voices that we talked about, I think 2 weeks ago, they're anticipating that they're going to be on pause for a while here. And that, you know, I guess, as my brother mentioned, the world central bank is what it is at this point.
Well, there we had the Fed minutes. Beyond that, what were some of the other catalysts this week on Wall Street? And I'm hoping you talk about Pfizer and Allergan, because I thought that was an interesting case.
It was. And so I guess if we kind of turn from the macro level down to the micro, there wasn't a whole lot of macro that went on this week, except for the Fed minutes. Janet Yellen spoke. I can talk about that in a minute. But, you know, Pfizer and Allergan, essentially, it's been a deal breaker for them. They've separated from their discussions to unify based on some of those moves by Congress. And so essentially by those moves, they've broken free. But you know what that did is it really lifted the healthcare sector in most of this week, some profit taking on Friday, but it lifted that sector up mostly because I think mergers and acquisition activity is going to have to shift maybe a little bit away from those two names, and they're going to look for other alternatives. You know, what are the alternatives for Pfizer and Allergan now? And there were many names that really got a lift from that. So, you know, the sector had a lot of weakness ahead of time. And so positioning wise, this little move here has helped, I think, provide a little bit of an opportunity for some allocation changes back into the sector for maybe for some investors and managers. But, you know, another micro level kind of note here, I thought Janet Yellen's comments about valuations Thursday was very helpful for the bulls. I don't know if you recall, John, back in, I think, July of 2014, she made the mistake, or I don't know if it's a mistake, if we want to call it that. She definitely hasn't done it much since. But she talked about the overvalued asset prices and possibly even a bubble in biotech. And we saw a decent correction in that. But funny, right before the whole industry group jumped another 50% over the next year. So not great timing on Yellen's part, but, you know, who has the best timing as a central banker when it comes to those types of things? You know, I don't know who. But, you know, it's since come down. Since then, over the last year, if you look at biotech, it's really struggled. But the last major, I guess, catalyst this week that I want to talk about is oil, which, as our listeners should know by now, has had a very high trading correlation with the market, you know, really plunging in January and essentially right with the economy concerns and the market. And since the dollar has weakened a little bit on the Fed going on pause, and we also got like the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi said, I think we've done enough. So the dollar has weakened recently. That's helped lift gold. It's helped lift oil. And then, of course, we had those discussions between OPEC and Russia to freeze January production levels. And that was back in February. But, you know, that was just talk. While Iran's oil minister in February stated it plans to back any measures which help stabilize the market and improve the price, it really wasn't clear if that meant, okay, are you going to cut production? You know, you back any kind of move. That's great. Sounds great. That's a great soundboard. But, you know, where's the rubber going to hit the road for oil production levels for Iran? And just as, you know, the handcuffs are being taken off, they have stated recently that they plan to get production levels back up to pre-sanction levels. And then there's Saudi Arabia, John. They were talking this week. They recently said that they don't plan to freeze unless joined by Iran. You know, they're diametrically opposed to each other politically with Yemen. What's going on there? They're opposed to each other and they're imposed with production levels. Saudi Arabia was trying to gain market share and now they've got to compete with Iran coming online. So there will be a joint meeting on April 17th. So there will be a lot of headlines surrounding that date. And that's basically to finally hash out essentially this production and freezing agreement. So we'll see. Saudi Arabia and Iran, diametrically opposed. And you look at them trying to come to an agreement, it'll be interesting. That's like putting the Democrats and Republicans to try and agree on healthcare reform or, you know, immigration reform. I read one analyst say he's never seen Russia honor any such agreement. So, you know, a lot of this is just talk. It's great for headlines and that does move markets, but is this really a long-term solution? We'll have to just see. I don't think so.
Well, there you have it, I guess. Next week should be interesting as we dive into the beginning of the first quarter earnings season. We were just commenting here today, it's like, wow, we already blew through first quarter.
I know.
How did we do that? Anything else other than the earnings reports that are going to start coming out? Are you listening, what, post-earnings conference calls?
Yeah, you're always listening in to see what Main Street is saying, getting an idea from corporate America of what they're interested in, what are their concerns. We've seen, you know, CFO reports that show they're very concerned about a decline in profitability. And we've seen corporate profits. You know, that's something that we've been very concerned as actually very much led in kind of telling recessions in the past. And that's been in decline for a while here. We want to obviously hear from the suits. Just what are they seeing and are they ramping up capital spending? Are there hirings going on for each of these individual companies, the sectors, the industry groups? You know, is that confirming what we're seeing in the broad employment data? You know, just this week, John, the unemployment claims marked the longest streak below 300,000 since the early 70s. And so we want to see that those two are matching, corporate America versus kind of the numbers we're getting out of Washington. I'm interested to hear from the financials as they've had a real rough time of things given, you know, interest rate expectations And so I'll be interested to see what they're doing based on current events, what they feel with the economy. Are they seeing new loans coming out? Are they making it up elsewhere? And of course, in oil, we want to hear that companies are capitalized. The biggest concern in high yield since July of last year has been mainly tied to the oil sector. You know, are we looking at paring down some debt like Chesapeake announced in early March? Those are the kinds of things I'll be looking for. Economic wise, not a lot of big news. I think at the end of the week on Friday, we should get some CPI data throughout the week. Friday should have some key manufacturing data points, industrial production. But mainly, no, earnings will be the name of the game, my guess, until we hear maybe from OPEC on the 17th.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Artificial intelligence just got a little bit smarter. So writes Matthew Bay. He is the science and technology analyst at Stratfor. And Matt, tell us about some of the recent significant breakthroughs we've seen in AI, most notably by Google. I guess not surprising considering what a behemoth they are. But you talk about some important milestones that they have achieved in this race to build machines that are better and faster than us. Why don't you explain for our listeners what has taken place?
So in the last month, we've seen AlphaGo, which is Google's platform to play the Go game, which is an Asian game that's kind of like chess, but a lot more complicated. I mean, I believe there's more possibilities in that game in terms of the way that the board is and there are atoms in the universe. So it's a very complex game that actually the players don't necessarily play by, you know, thinking of all the possibilities of the moves, 15 moves down the road or 25 moves down the road like you might do in chess. Instead, it's much more about kind of perceiving the way that the board looks as opposed to trying to evaluate the way that the board works. So Google wrote a program called AlphaGo that is using advanced neural networks computing as a way to kind of solve that kind of a problem, one that's more based on perception as opposed to brute forcing that. So they were actually able to play Lee Sedol, one of the biggest and most successful Go players in the world, and actually beat him 4 games out of 5. So that's kind of the big development that they've done. And then the secondary thing that has also happened over the last month is that one of Google's robots has also kind of used the same sort of base technology to kind of perceive objects in a room and actually move those objects out of the way from its robotic arm to pick up a different object. This is something that's actually pretty revolutionary when you talk about some of the potential impacts for artificial intelligence in, say, the work environment or other places.
Well, after a nice rise coming out of the February lows, the stock market is in stall speed. Joining us on the program from New Albion Partners is Dan Wodrobski. Dan, as I look at a chart of the S&P, we saw those almost like a double bottom last August and September. Then we had a nice pop up. And then all of a sudden, it started all over again in January and February. But since the bottom in February, we've had a nice run here. So are we in stall speed or are we topping out here?
Well, thanks for having me on the program. My opinion is a stall state. I mean, if you had to press me for an answer here, we do not view the action, not only for the last several months, but really the last 2 years, and we'll talk about that in a second, but we view that action not as a secular market top, but actually what will ultimately be proven in hindsight to be a stealth bear market correction in time rather than in price. And I think the market is still really undergoing this phase. And quite frankly, over the short run, I think we have maybe one more wave down to complete this bottoming process before things really start to take off, quite frankly. I don't know how things shake out to the decimal on December 31st, 2016, but we do believe that eventually, sooner rather than later, the markets as gauged by the benchmark S&P 500 are going to break out to new all-time highs and continue to press higher, not only for the next couple of years, but probably, in my opinion, for the next several.
Dan, when you look at this chart, we've had these downturns, and of course we had the major sell-off that we saw in the S&P in 2011. From a fundamental point of view, I take a look at interest rates are still very accommodative, even though the Fed has raised interest rates a quarter of a point. You've got to look at what Europe's doing. You have to look at what Japan. I mean, most of the world is in an accommodative mode. So if we were to take off again, what would be a catalyst, in your opinion, to ignite that?
Well, I think it would be growth. I think it's growth specific to the U.S. I mean, right now, U.S. markets are acting really as a global safe haven and really one of the only bastions of growth, be it slow growth. But I really think that's the catalyst here. I mean, I see the economy as improving. We know there was really, in my opinion, a major breakout in labor participation rate recently within a key demographic that drives consumer activity here in this country. We know that wage inflation, I would rather call it reflation, is starting to creep up. We know that energy prices remain low. We know that corporations are flush with cash on their balance sheets. They've done a great job cleaning up their balance sheets. We know that households have some of the best debt servicing ratios in 20, 30 years. So they've done a good job building net worth, cleaning up their balance sheets over these last several years. So we think all those things that have streamlined over the last several years after the financial crisis of 08, 09 are going to come together with positive demographics in this country over the next decade or so. You and I have talked about this in the past, but this remains a key driver in my mind as to future economic growth here in the country, and that's the millennials approaching family formation in massive numbers. In fact, within the next 10 to 15 years, new household formation stands to reach all-time highs once again. I think that's a tremendous driver for potential economic stimulus and money velocity in the country. This group of young people born between the years of 1980-2000 number anywhere from 85 to 90 million have never before in this country participated in the economy. They haven't been consumers, big consumers yet. They certainly haven't been producers. Or they haven't been investors, savers. So this is a new pool of potential activity that is really about to be integrated into this economy. I think it's going to be disruptive. I think it's going to allow for a lot more economic growth than people realize. The market is really poised to take advantage. The reason I say this is because we're coming into this demographic wave at a really attractive multiple. Don't forget that the markets, the S&P 500, even though it's trading, you know, just off all-time highs, 2135, is at a multiple much lower than prior secular peaks going back 15, 16 years. I mean, today the S&P trades maybe 15, 16 times. I'll give you 17 times. And that's at a price point of 2,000 to 2,100. Remember that in 2007, the S&P was trading at 1,500 at a multiple of 27, 28 times. And then if you could recollect as far back as 99, 2000 during the tech bubble, the S&P was trading at 1,500 on a price basis with a multiple north of 40 times. So the market is telling me, hey, we're breaking out to new all-time price highs at a multiple that's just coming off of secular lows, at a point in time in history where a new demographic boom is about to come online and really generate a lot of economic velocity and activity. To me, that's very, very bullish going forward. So you can argue that rates are accommodative. I'm going to argue that rates are probably going to stay accommodative for the next several years. I do believe there is a secular bottom taking place here in interest rates, but our studies of the historical data suggest these secular bottoms could take upwards of 10 years. If we look at the low on the 10-year note yield specifically as sort of a gauge of our interest rate environment, the low was hit in July of 2012. So already we have been basing in terms of interest rates for the last 3 or 4 years. So I think we have several years more to see accommodative policy in terms of the cost of capital. Against that backdrop, we have an attractive market multiple as sort of the gauge of the private sector. And we have potential, in my opinion, explosive growth from this new demographic wave that's really coming online here.
When you look at this rally that we saw coming out of February, it was broad-based. We saw a lot of depressed groups like materials and energy do very well. We saw commodities respond, emerging markets. Along with that, Dan, besides those depressed groups, we also saw very defensive sectors of the economy do well, telecoms, consumer staples. So what does that tell you about this market?
A couple of things. I mean, typically those tend to do well on a relative basis when the market is in correction mode. In my opinion, I disagree that they were the sole leaders. When I look at coming off February levels, to me, it was based in technology and semiconductors. We saw industrials heat up dramatically from the lows of February. Housing, since the bottom in February, housing has outpaced the broader S&P 500. And also, interestingly enough, mid-caps and small-caps have been outperforming large-caps since those lows. So I'd almost disagree. I think staples and telecom are certainly a part of it. But to say that defensives were leading, I don't know. I'm not seeing that. Because even when I look at healthcare has underperformed since the February lows. So to me, this was more sort of a pro-growth, pro-cyclical rally. And one of the interesting sidebars to that is watch your buybacks. A lot of people will argue that stock buybacks, corporate buybacks are really fueling this market. I don't disagree that they are influencing what's happening, but what we're starting to see here is during risk-on phases in the markets, your buybacks are actually underperforming, and all the rotation, all the outsized performance is really geared towards those more pro-growth, pro-cyclical groups. So that, in my mind, is very bullish. And I think when the market is showing its risk-on phase, the breadth seems decent. The appetite for risk seems to return in terms of pro-growth, pro-cyclical groups. And really, the only group that is absent in my mind that really needs a lot of improvement would be the banks and the financials. I think that's more predicated upon where interest rates are. We still see a very tight correlation between bank stock performance and the general trend in rates at the long end of the curve. So while rates remain stubborn and policy remains accommodative, the banks probably aren't going to be a major part. And other groups such as maybe industrials, technology, semis, home builders, things like that, they're probably going to have to take a bigger role.
Let's talk about one sector that is really starting to break out, and that is gold. What's your take on gold here? And with gold breaking out, is that telling us anything about risk? What does it signify in your opinion?
Well, gold to me signals a global safe haven trade, more so probably against currency risks than anything else. I mean, we don't look at gold as inflationary at this point because we're not seeing a lot of underlying inflationary signals in the broader economy. We view the market cycle as reflationary, coming off generational lows in interest rates and a deleveraging or deflationary bear cycle that we really experienced over the last decade. I think when we're talking about gold as a hedge here, it really has to do with the dollar index right now. And if you look at the dollar charts, the U.S. dollar charts in terms of the basket currency, it does look very top heavy here. In fact, we're using the 94 level on a dollar index as sort of a gauge, as sort of a barrier to see can dollar selling really take off. I think so. If it does, you could see higher volatility in the global equity markets. But in terms of is gold signaling a major top in the risk markets by what it's doing, I don't think so at this point. Remember, gold's been in a downtrend for a number of years. I think gold is basically starting to base more so from oversold levels and some concerns in the currency markets, particularly the dollar index. But we don't see it as a major enemy to the types of technical action that we're seeing in the stock markets, and certainly not the U.S. stock markets at this point.
So you believe that perhaps we have one more downturn or maybe another downturn before stocks really take off. What kind of things would you be looking at to confirm that?
We tried to study the anatomy of significant market bottoms. One of the studies we did was to go back in maybe the last 15, 16 years for this prior bear cycle that we were in since 1999 to 2000. And what we found was that the more significant market bottoms tended to come in three stages. And the duration there really varied. It could come within a matter of weeks. Sometimes it stretched out for close to a year. But in any event, you had this three-point bottom before the market broke out, based, and went considerably higher. In each of those stages, you had these sort of capitulation events. And by capitulation events, we're looking for 90% downside days. This is a popular concept with technicians and market watchers. And 90% downside days when 90% of the listed stocks are in the red and 90% of the trading volume is selling, is on the sell side. So you're talking about a market washout. And typically, in each of these waves, you can see sometimes several of these 90% downside days. It's not just one day. It's more of a process. So as we come into this third and final wave, one of the things I'm going to be looking for are these 90% downside days. Now, interestingly enough, yesterday, before the market stabilized towards the end of the day's trading, we did see a 90% downside day in the S&P 500. So, you know, 90% of the stocks were in the red yesterday. Remember, when you talk about capitulation or, you know, that flush, people tend to think of a crash or this major newsworthy event breaking to new lows. You know, it doesn't have to be. Remember, one of the concepts we're looking at is a stealth bear market in time rather than price. And what happens in a bear market in time, or a correction in time rather than in price, the market tends to grind sideways without giving you any of those explosive historical events like a 1987 crash or a 2010 flash crash. But it grinds sideways, and within there, you're flushing out different sectors and then different areas of the market really underneath the surface. And in that respect, the market has been in a very broad-based correction in time since 2014, nearly 2 years ago, when the Russell made its high early in the year. I think it was January 2014, and then proceeded the next 2 years to trade sideways to down. So while everybody was moving towards and gravitating towards safety of the large-cap stocks, and the S&Ps held up reasonably well, underneath the surface, small and mid-cap stocks were getting taken apart on a price basis. And so we've seen a lot of those capitulation or 90% downside days underneath the surface in the smaller cap realm over the last 2 years. And I effectively think that has done a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of repricing these markets at a more attractive, you know, valuation, given what we see economically going forward. So with this last wave, I do expect to see, you know, more 90% days. We did see one yesterday. You do not have to make new lows with this. It could be a very shallow bottom here. The S&P may not even break 1950 on something like this. Remember, the February lows were around 1800. I think it was like 1810 or 1812 or something. So we're saying this third bottom, it doesn't have to break to new lows. It could be rather shallow. But once we go through that final wave and then we break out, we can do, you know, a lot of good technical work on the upside, and we have breadth as gauged by the NYSE cumulative advanced decline line confirming the action. We think the market move can actually be pretty explosive going forward.
Well, certainly when you take a look at this market since 2014 and where we are today, it's been back and forth, back and forth. But certainly we haven't seen the downward swoons as we did, for example, in 2000 to 2002 or in 2007. So we haven't seen those big downturns. Do you think a lot of that has to do with the monetary environment that we're working in, because there's plenty of global liquidity?
Yes and no. I mean, those were watershed events. Remember, the bear market from 2000 to 2002, your multiple on the S&P at the peak was 46 times. The NASDAQ was something ridiculous, like 80 times, if you remember that bubble.
Oh, yeah.
So that's one of the reasons, you know, you launched into a 2 or 3 year cyclical bear market that took away, what was it, 70% of the NASDAQ, well, you know, virtually half of the S&P 500. Again, a generational cycle peak. 2007, 2008 was another generational peak. I mean, that was a credit bubble gone bust. That was a massive liquidity event. So today, I think in one respect, you are right. Monetary policy is much more accommodative. The Fed has learned what it needs to do to keep this market stabilized. But at the same time, the market stands in a much more healthy manner. Again, multiple is much lower. Its adoption by Main Street, much, much lower. In other words, you don't have the greed and the frenzy of the retail investors trading this market. If anything, they're still firmly pressed into cash position and fixed income and muni bonds. That's really where they're staying now. So this has been a low adoption, low volume bull market that I do not think has the same underlying stresses and strains as those last two cycles. And I think that's exactly why we're seeing more of a correction in time, more so than in price, and that this is not going to evolve into another structural down cycle the way those prior years had formed.
Well, certainly, if we take a look at interest rates on this Friday, you've got the 10-year Treasury note somewhere around a little over 1.7%. And Dan, at least for the first time in my career, you can get dividend yields on stocks. I don't care if you're looking at a Cisco with 3.6% or you're looking at an Exxon at 4. I never saw that in the first couple decades of my career. Interest rates are always much higher.
Yeah, it's compelling. One of the things we look at when we look at this site, like our model is this long cycle model, and we incorporate how stocks have interacted with commodities and interest rates. And the overlay that we think is one of the huge driving forces to this is the relative attractiveness of the private sector versus the public sector. And what I mean by private sector, this is going to be, you know, public corporations, the stock market, as well as households versus our federal government and its own balance sheets and business practices. And what happens when you hit these generational troughs and peaks, I think is something we're seeing today. The private sector now stands ridiculously lean and mean and attractive relative to our public sector, which is bloated with debt and overrun. And I think what's happening is we're seeing a generational top in our sovereign debt markets. I think this is exactly what we're going through. And you're going to, in the years ahead, see a continual shift away from the public sector, and that's the treasury markets, towards the private sector, which again has a much more attractive valuation. And to your point, you have something like a Cisco, which is a growth vehicle, or even McDonald's. Cisco's PE today is 14 times. So now you have a decent, I would say a very attractive multiple. It's in the right group. The whole group is not ridiculously overpriced. It pays close to 4% against a government bond instrument that has traded sideways for the last 2 years and is paying at best 1.5%. The market is going to continually gravitate away from this one top-heavy side, which is the public sector. And like a vacuum, it's going to be attracted towards the private sector. I think that's one of the reasons why we see explosive inflationary pressures moving into equities over the next several years.
Given this fact that maybe we have another leg down in this corrective process, as you look at the market and sectors, if you had to put money to work, where would you put it?
Number one, you can do passive investing and do very well in a secular bull market. A secular bull market is a rising tide bull market. 1982 to 2000 is a great example. And you could buy broad-based vehicles like the Spiders ETF, which is basically the S&P 500. And I think you're going to do very well. Our call basically for the next, I would say, 5 to 10 years is going to be overweight U.S. equities relative to any bonds, especially treasuries, as well as the commodity markets. We've always seen a negative correlation there. In terms of sector work and some of the thematic things that we're seeing, I do believe investors have to get on board with the demographic call here, and that's the coming wave of millennials into the family formation years. We want to track their preferences, their spending patterns, the things they're going to be involved in as an investment vehicle. And I think one of the ways you could do that, quite frankly, is the housing market. I mean, we put out a piece earlier this week on new household formation and how well relative performance of some of the stocks you wouldn't normally think of track to that data point, something like a Whirlpool, which is a very bullish chart pattern that has a very high correlation to new household formation going back the last 30, 40 years. So other plays like that would be something like Trix or Leggett & Platt or even Ethan Allen. So I would look at the housing play, not necessarily the home builders. We don't know who's going to win, whether it's going to be Lennar or Hovnanian. That's not where I'm betting on. I'm looking at the derivative input plays. You know, Trex is building supplies, Whirlpool is appliances, Ethan Allen and Lazy Boy are furniture. These are going to be consumer products that I think are going to be able to really capitalize on new household formation over the next 10 to 15 years. So that would be one area that I would be very excited about. Another area that I think is shaping up very well is broader technology. And these are some of the companies that are able to adopt and change to changing environments and the needs of this new millennial. One of the things I heard, you'll always attach Apple to the millennials in terms of the company that knows its customer base. One thing I'm consistently hearing from that group of young people, is 20 to 30-year-olds, is how well Microsoft has adapted and how well their products are accepted by that group, much more so than Apple. And when you look at a chart on Microsoft, it is explosive. It has a 10 to 15-year base behind it. I think it's going to keep moving higher. So, you know, any of those companies that can adapt to that shifting demographic and technology, I certainly think are going to be winners. That's not to say that Apple is the loser here. There's no knock against Apple here. I'm just saying things that you wouldn't normally think of are going to track really well. We built actually a millennial discretionary index in which we looked at stocks where 30% of them or more of their revenues were driven by 25 to 35-year-olds, or 30% or more of their web traffic or marketing advertising was geared towards that millennial group, 25 to 35-year-olds. And obviously some of the stocks that would fall into that would be a Twitter or Facebook, also Apple, but also some surprising ones, you know, Ford, Target, things like that. And they have tracked really well as this group moves into family formation, becomes, you know, a producer and a consumer in this economy. So the millennials would be my number one group that I want to track in terms of a long-term thematic play in this next secular bull market. I'm not saying it's the only one. There's going to be a number of things that eventually evolve. I mean, to me, this is going to be a reflationary bull market cycle. As we mentioned earlier, I believe interest rates are now making a generational low or generational base, which tells me we're going to have a multiple expansion cycle against higher interest rates going forward. Again, the base can take a number of years to form, but I think we're here. It's sideways to up from here. That tells me that eventually banks and financials are going to take a bigger role in lifting the stock market higher. Don't forget the banks still comprise anywhere from 13, 14, even 15% of the S&P 500. They've been stuck in the mud in this low-rate environment. But if we're correct on our call that this is a reflationary bull cycle, so higher stocks against modestly higher interest rates, we're not calling for hyperinflation or stagflation by any means. But if that is the case, you're going to start to see banks and financials act a lot better in the years ahead as well. And again, I would tie it back into the millennial play where you have those companies that are able to capitalize on this new group. And I would put out Charles Schwab or an E-Trade that have a huge book of new millennial customers, have really tapped into that cohort as a new potential client and are doing very well with that. These are some of the best charts out there. And I think eventually these would be some of the types of stocks that are going to lead the financials group higher. Is that a play for tomorrow? No. Is that a play for the next several years? I believe absolutely.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Yeah, the best way would be to reach out to me via email. It's going to be a long one, so get your pens ready, but it is dwontropsky@newalbionpartners.com. We are based in New York. I also work with a credit strategist by the name of Brian Reynolds, who is fabulous. So you can reach out to us that way, and we'd be happy to get back to you.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
For many years, financial commentators have been keeping a close eye on a very important indicator. It's called margin debt, and according to our next guest, Jesse Felder, it's giving a very clear warning sign for the stock market right now. Jesse, I know you have a lot to tell our audience today, and they're going to be very interested to hear some of the charts and data that we're going to go through, which I'll link out to where this interview is located on Financial Sense. But first, tell our audience a little bit about your background.
Sure. I first became interested in the financial markets when I was a young kid. My dad bought an Apple IIe and he got me a game called Millionaire. This was probably in early 80s. And it was a stock market simulator. That got me hooked on the markets. I started actually reading Barron's on the weekends and stuff. Your typical elementary schooler. Right after I graduated college, I went to work for Bear Stearns. I just kind of knew that's what I wanted to do. I was a bear for a couple years before I actually found somebody there who was really trying to do something different. And basically, he was running a hedge fund within Bear. So I started working with him. We left about a year later and started our own firm in Santa Monica, California, where we started three hedge funds, and then we had our own broker-dealer, investment advisor, and kind of were doing a variety of different things. But that was 97. I did that for 3 years, right into the peak of the dot-com bubble. Decided I wanted to get out of the hedge fund business then, and I actually quit. March of 2000, I left the hedge fund, and basically I've been running a family office, a pretty small family office, for the last 16 years. That's my professional background.
Well, after a while, while, markets seem to be settling back into a sideways pattern. What does this mean for commodities, which we've seen a big jump in gold and oil recently? Joining us on the program is Greg Weldon. Greg, let's begin with the price of gold. I know you wrote a book on gold, Gold Bootcamp, a number of years ago. What is gold's recent rise telling you, and what's your perspective on the precious metal?
Well, my perspective, first of all, is to take a giant step back and to go back to when I wrote the book. In fact, in 2006, early 2007, we were bullish on gold at that point. We said you had credit issues in the U.S. linked to real estate. You know, we were, you know, pretty much called exactly as it played out, to the degree that the, you know, the Fed would be buying trillions of dollars of treasury debt and monetizing it. And I remember going on CNBC on one of the popular shows and kind of getting laughed off stage, suggesting such monetary heresy that the Fed would buy trillions of dollars of treasury debt. You know, that was unheard of. Now, I see a very similar setup here. We were bullish on gold then. It was 450. We said it would go to 1200. We were wrong. It went to 1900. I'm more bullish now than I was then. But within the bigger picture context, to go back to taking a giant step back, that was, you know, an acceleration then in 2006 and 7 in a bull market that was born really in 1999 with the Washington Accord. You made your bottom there. The swaps shifted and everything kind of changed from that point forward. It was, in fact, a 12-year bull market that's had a 4-year correction. Okay, so that's a 3-to-1 ratio. We start talking Fibonacci's. It was almost a perfect 50% Fibonacci correction. And you found tremendous support and many like tailed candlestick type reversal patterns from below the 50% Fibonacci level. So to me, this is mapped out quite nicely as if you could have written a textbook on technical analysis 101. You throw in the fundamentals of what's going on with the beginnings of the end of, you know, QE monetary policy actually works, then that's an interesting overlay, particularly as we come out of what we just saw in 2015, which was expectations of Fed rate hikes, abandoning that safety net that they got everyone to buy stocks based on this we got your back mentality, and all of a sudden they're saying we don't got your back anymore. And you saw what happened. Not only that, but the dollar appreciates because this would be, you know, really the only major central bank actually hiking interest rates and theoretically, quote unquote, tightening policy. And that just crushed commodities, crushed emerging markets. And the Fed knows they can't afford another leg in the dollar. We talked about this the last time I was on your program. It's, you know, intensified ever since. And to the degree that now the Fed has done what we said at the beginning of the year was the wild card for 2016 was the Fed specifically targeting the dollar. Dollar's in play. Gold is higher. It's about as bullish a scenario as you can create outside of they make policy errors here on the side of tightening.
Yeah, what is it telling you about tightening, Greg, when they took almost a whole year to raise interest rates 0.25 point, as they did in December? And then, of course, they were talking about 4 rate hikes. Then they get to March and they say, no, only 2. And then the recent speech implies maybe they might not even go at all. In fact, reverse direction. You and I were talking before we went on the air, and let's bring this into focus, the Danish Central Bank, which may be experiencing similar issues.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The Danish Central Bank raised rates in January under the premise of we're beginning a normalization process where they had, you know, cut rates to minus 75 basis points, the most aggressive central bank at that time in terms of trying to defend a currency peg against the euro, trying to keep their currency from appreciating, because we know it's all about currencies. I mean, this thing begins and ends with currency wars. I mean, it really does. And, you know, in a world where you don't have sufficient growth to make the pie bigger, you're fighting, you know, for a same size piece of pie with an increasingly larger amount of central banks that need to eat pizza pie, so on and so forth. You know the analogy I'm trying to make. The bottom line is you saw the intensification of that currency war when the Fed even began to talk about hiking rates. Now, from the Fed's perspective, they have all but told us, and the most recent speech by Janet Yellen was fascinating with what she said, that for at least the last 2 years, since 2014, same speech, New York Economic Club in 2014, about the automatic stabilizer. This is kind of their new tool, which essentially they're telling us, okay, that we feel that if we communicate what we would do if we saw a certain scenario play out, that when we do communicate that we're thinking about doing it, it's as if we were doing it and the market should respond accordingly and therefore kind of cushion the need to actually do anything. Now, they worked that to some degree, and they went too far, but they worked out to some degree with tightening. Okay. Look at all the tightening that they did in the forward markets without ever raising rates. It was a heck of a lot. You drove the 3-month deposit rate for the end of 2017 to a 250-point premium over Europe, when in fact the real spread is virtually still nothing, even though they've actually raised rates 25 basis points. That's what drove the dollar higher. It was the flip side was QE in Europe, which drove the euro lower. You had both of those things working. So now they're shifting the other way. And now you start to see, you know, we've dropped our thought processes around how many times you're going to hike rates this year. The Fed's only at one more hike. The market is not even 100% pricing that in. Okay. And Yellen all of a sudden is dangling, you know, this automatic stabilizer the other way on an asymmetrical policy where if we have to ease, we don't have as much room as we'd like to have. And then she dangles QE4 in front of us. So, you know, really this is policy without having to really make any real changes other than the rhetoric. And they've done a masterful job. The problem is, you know, it's such a tenuous situation that they risk kind of losing control at any time. That brings us back to the Danish Central Bank, and I'd be happy to elaborate if you want me to keep on with this answer.
Yeah, I'd like to do that because as I looked at their reasons for raising rates, usually you see a central bank do that when the economy is overheating, you've got inflationary forces at work. None of that was existing at the time they began this rate raising cycle. So to me, Greg, it seems like what they were trying to do is put some bullets back into the chamber in case they got to the next crisis. Here we are right now. They've only raised interest rates a quarter of a point. But as you pointed out, if you take a look at corporate bond spreads and a number of things, rates have risen much, much more than that quarter point would imply. What do they do when they get to another crisis, having only raised interest rates a quarter of a point? I mean, what's next? QE4, 5, negative interest rates? What do they have left in their arsenal to work with?
Basically, the answer is D, all of the above, and then probably something new. So, you know, one of the things we have to keep in mind is, you know, I always kind of see things happening more quickly than they do. And that perspective has taught me some respect for the Fed and other central banks, at least in the sense of first, I don't envy them their job. It's an impossible task. It's about pain avoidance, not the right academic thing to do. That's no longer a solution. But more so, B, in their creativity and their ability to continually come up with ways to keep this thing floating. You have to give them some credit for that. I talked in the book in 2006. I took this to where we are right now. And, you know, we're in this point where I called it the degradation of stimulus return. And you are getting less bang for your buck with every dollar you print. Guess what? You've increased money supply. You've increased balance sheets, which means you have to exponentially increase QE4 to make it as effective as QE3 and so on and so forth. At some point, that runs out. And that is the problem and the conundrum in the sense that does it take getting to monetary Armageddon, which is what I called it in the book, where the Fed basically, you know, they turn the keys and they're in the bunker and you lift up the little thing and you hit the switch. And guess what? The Fed just bought every bond the Treasury ever printed. That could happen. It's kind of where you're headed. I mean, now that's a dramatic overstatement for sure, but it's not a completely insane thought process given the direction we're headed, given what the BOJ has already done in terms of their balance sheet, in terms of the JGB market, in terms of liquidity. You have all other kinds of issues starting to pop up there too. So, you know, I think what they're doing right now is the beginning of the shift. That's why, to me, the speech by Yellen, when it was a week or a week or two ago, was tectonic in terms of its shift of the monetary plates here. And again, they talk consistently. They have mentioned, and it becomes a cacophony because it's so loud now and it's used so many times. But the asymmetrical policy dynamic, okay, and then again, back to this automatic stabilizer thing. So even within the most recent minutes, when they're talking about these things now, the people on the Fed are disagreeing. So now you not only have uncertainty in the backdrop, in the macro fiber, but you have uncertainty on the Fed. And I mean, at some point you wonder, maybe one of the things they should do that they're not doing is become less transparent. Stop talking. Stop showing how confused you are because you're only confusing people.
You know, this brings an interesting question, and let's throw this possibility out. We're seeing the limits of monetary policy. In other words, we're getting less bang for the buck for each new monetary stimulus. Greg, we know that monetary stimulus works best with fiscal stimulus. Could we see in the future, or let's say we get into a recession or an economic downturn, where the government just comes up with a massive stimulus program, very much like what Obama did in 2009, and the Fed came in and announced QE1. So basically, the government spends a whole bunch of money, and you have the Fed coming in and mopping up and paying for it all.
Yeah, and there's actually talk in Europe about this, even among the monetary circles, that maybe the focus now needs to shift to the fiscal side. The problem, and we know what the problem is, $19 trillion of debt in the U.S. The problem is, outside of Germany and one or two others, almost every country in Europe out of the 27 EU nations has expanded their debt since 2008. And most of those countries are at record levels, including Italy. And when you look at places like Belgium and the Netherlands, where they're triple A rated on a population adjusted basis, their debt is as high, and in the case of Belgium, higher than Italy's is on a population adjusted basis. So the issue there is, sure, could they do more? Absolutely. But where does that run into a problem too? You hear no discussion whatsoever about a sovereign debt crisis anymore. And I'll tell you what, these seeds are sown, and you want to talk about looking for green shoots in the economy. You see green shoots of another sovereign debt crisis because you've had this phenomenal opportunity with the way the interest rates have, with the way the curves have flattened, and so on and so forth. And yet still, every country is in worse shape. And you can point to the U.S. and you can say, look, okay, our deficit is still only about half of what it was at its peak. Okay, but before 2009, the deficit right now would have been a record, and it's moving in the opposite direction already. So where is it where you say uncle on monetary policy? Where is it you say uncle on fiscal policy? And without being a gloom and doomer, because again, you give them a lack of credit for their ability to be creative, but they're going to be really creative here. And from a fiscal standpoint, this is where the competition could get fierce in terms of, you talk about social unrest, A, okay, with the high youth unemployment. We could talk about that in the U.S. The numbers from last Friday were pretty shocking, frankly. Places like Spain always comes to mind with a near 50% youthful unemployment rate. But then you also talk about something's got to give, just generally speaking, in terms of interest rates. And that's where it all comes down to. And then we can even take it further. We tie it to the U.S. banks, where they still hold, you know, over $220 trillion in derivatives linked to interest rates. The Fed is walking such a tightrope over such a ravine. It really is a scary thought process in terms of, you know, at what point is everything stretched so far that it just lets go and kind of collapses onto itself? That's always the fear.
Yeah, let's relate this back to gold, because when we were in a severe deflationary environment, if we go back to the 30s, the way Roosevelt brought us out of it was devalued and sort of reset the clock. Is that a possibility in your mind, Greg, that down the road, I mean, we're at $19 trillion by the time Obama leaves office in January, it'll be close to $20 trillion. And, you know, if interest rates were to rise for every 1% increase in interest rates, that's another 200-something billion in interest expense. It was rather interesting. I was looking at Treasury debt. In 2008, we had $10 trillion in debt, and the government spent $451 billion in interest. You know, fast forward about 8 years later, add $8 trillion more in debt, and the government's spending $50 billion less in interest expense. Do they do a reset and devalue, just like Roosevelt did, a massive devaluation set against gold overnight?
Yeah, well, I think that, Jim, both you and I would immediately point out the problem with that is if, you know, you wanted to even say we'll do a, you know, a 10-to-1 ratio and try and somehow link it to a price on gold, you still not enough gold in the world to cover that trade. So this is the issue. And that is where, you know, some of the real hardcore gold bugs start talking about prices that seem incredulous, but maybe they really aren't. I mean, we're not like that. I mean, you know, our target on this next phase has been, and, you know, always has been throughout this entire bigger picture thing we're talking about, you know, going back to 1999, you remember I was on the gold floor in the 80s when gold was last, you know, at this kind of height of volatility. And from my perspective, it only gets wider. So I'm, you know, longer term, 2400, could they reset? Sure, they could. That's monetary Armageddon. They basically just, you know, push the button, wipe out all that debt and figure out, you know, where does the dollar fall? The problem is, you know, you have all these other countries attempting to do the same thing, you know, and that is what makes it exciting potentially for gold. It also then creates fear. I got a lot of European clients. They don't want to put money in a U.S. bank to save their lives because there's actual fear out there about when is the day when, you know, the government starts seizing assets. I mean, I think we got many, many steps before we get to any possible outcome that would be like that. And the probabilities are still on the lower side rather than the higher side. But that fear is very real out there. And that fear itself could be the kind of thing that becomes self-fulfilling.
You know, it's interesting. There are a number of books out there recently, Mervyn King's The End of Alchemy and Muhammad Al-Aryan's The Only Game in Town. And you really wonder if we are in the final phases of the end game, Greg, because Japan has gone to negative interest rates. And what did they find? There's a run on safes. You couldn't even get safes. You know, Japanese investors are saying, you know what, I'm not going to keep my money in the bank and pay them interest. I'll just get a safe and get cash. So it seems like This reminds me almost of the end of the 70s when, you know, complete confidence was lost in the Fed's ability. And that's when we saw the big run up in gold. And you just wonder if we're approaching that end game where investors and especially the bond market start losing confidence in central banks and their ability to right the course.
I absolutely think we're at the beginning of the end game. The question is, you know, how long does it take to play out? And again, like I said earlier, I tend to be early in my calls because we're digging really, really deep, and it takes a level of awareness on behalf of the market before, you know, markets move in trend-like movement, secular moves. So one of the things I kind of like to say is, and maybe I should rewind, I don't like to say it, but it's something I do say because it makes sense to me, is, you know, we may not live to see the end game because they can keep pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And they've shown an amazing ability to be pushing it. I mean, this goes, you know, again, historians know how deep this runs, how far back it really goes, at least to Bretton Woods, at least to FDR. I mean, you can really tie it to a couple of starting points, if you will. Yes, I think we're absolutely in the beginnings of the end game. I think the gold market actually tells us that. I mean, if you had told someone 10 years ago, okay, that gold would be at $1,200, they would have thought that, I mean, things were going crazy, right? Because gold was at 400, okay? It's at 1,200. That says something. So what if it came down from 1900? So what? It's still $1,200. You know, relative to my entire experience in this business, that's unbelievable. So from that perspective, again, taking a giant step back and really understanding what that is telling you is, had you invested, you know, $1 million 10 years ago in a 10-year bond, you would have gotten back a modicum of yield and your principal back, and that would have been great. You would have been happy, right? Except it only buys half as much gold now as it did 10 years ago. Maybe one third as much. That's a pretty strong statement on a long-term picture when you start talking about the gold market. And, you know, that's where I come down to trying to time this thing and figure out exactly how many tangents that are going to be, how many nuances in the road that we're going to travel there are going to be. I mean, that's what makes it exciting. Get up every day to see what's going on, because it really is amazing to watch unfold. Trying to handicap, it's never been more difficult. And from that perspective, it's why we try and maintain a very broad view while digging into the most nuance of data to try and be as near term as possible, looking for tells that things are intensifying or that things are reversing or refuting our themes or, you know, confirming our themes. And right now, everything points in a direction that suggests what you're saying is becoming increasingly more probable that, you know, yeah, you have some kind of denouement out there that's going to be significant in its impact on the markets. And, you know, gold, whether it goes down less than everything else or goes up more than everything else, will still be the place to be.
So given where we are right now, we've seen this big run from gold when it bottomed in January. Now we're at roughly close to 1250. Do you think this is a good entry point, or do you think you would wait for a further pullback?
You know, Jim, that's the most pertinent question and maybe the hardest question to answer right now. I had thought you had your A wave down to just under 1210. You might, you know, bounce and then, you know, hit 1170, 1160 would be a more, you know, kind of normal textbook technical type correction off the move we had. But open interest has dropped a lot already, which suggests there's some more underlying demand in the market, we might think. If you look at ETFs and where they've come from and where they are now, and the mining shares, which are really just now breaking out, you know, we have a gold fund that's a leveraged, aggressive, bullish performing gold fund, basically hadn't been marketing it for the last 3 years. We started marketing it aggressively in November, December of last year. It's gotten a lot of interest, and that's always the question. And what I've been telling people that have asking me that in the last couple of weeks is, you know, you can wait for that correction to try and get, you know, a $30 or $40 better price. But the risk on the upside of missing the move is way larger than $30 or $40. And I hate missing moves. I hate chasing markets that you know are going to move and you waited and you thought you're trying to, you know, quibble for dollars relative to the bigger picture. So to my clients, what I'm telling them, my belief is you need to be involved. And if that means you buy it here, fine. And if that means, you know, 2 weeks from now, you're sitting on a $30 loss, that's just the way it is. And that's not abnormal. And so what? Bigger picture.
Well, listen, Greg, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, tell them how they could do so.
Yeah, it's www.weldononline.com, Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N, online.com. And that daily research, we do a daily video. We have a big PDF chart pack that goes with it, and Trade Lab, which is our specific trading recommendations in all the sectors, fixed income, foreign exchange, global stock indexes and ETFs, metals, energy, and agricultural commodities. And we do global macro as well. So sign up for a free 30-day free trial, and we're actually just getting ready to offer a special discount for first-time users. So it'd be a good time to kind of get in on our newly evolving website.
Now, coming up in the next hour is the big picture, which we do every single week as we try to put some sense into things that are going on. Putting sense into things this week, Jim goes on the record and we respond to email questions that people have sent into us over the last month or so, covering those issues that concern them. And we try to make some sense out of the whole thing. All of that coming up next on the big picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.